everyone. I'm Lauren Petrovic, and you're listening to the Responsible Luxury Podcast. This show is all about celebrating the most extraordinary leaders, culture changers, creatives, founders, and CEOs shaping the world of luxury today. Today's a very special episode of the podcast as we're coming to you live from Brooklyn, New York, with a remarkable group of ethical gem suppliers to discuss the state of the gemstone industry. Our focus turns to a clever group of entrepreneurs who are revolutionizing the gemstone industry by fostering transparent supply chains, empowering artisanal mining, and cutting communities worldwide. Their mission goes beyond the mere trade of exquisite gemstones. It encompasses the vital role of educating industry professionals and consumers on the significance of responsible sourcing practices. Drawing from my own entrepreneurial journey in the sustainable fine jewelry space, I know from experience the profound impact and meaningful connections that arise from collaborating with conscious and responsible suppliers and sourcing ethical gemstones. In this episode, we'll dive into the essence of sustainability within the gemstone trade, exploring its global implications and societal significance. We also discuss how technology, while a powerful tool, is only as effective as the intent behind its use. As we explore the rich culture of gem varieties originating across regions such as Australia, Brazil, Tanzania, Ethiopia, and beyond, one thing becomes abundantly clear: the deep-rooted foundation of trust within this community. While trust remains the linchpin upholding industry standards in a somewhat fragmented gemstone sector, we discuss the necessity for innovative solutions that bolster this trust with enhanced transparency and accountability mechanisms. I am very excited to share this one with you. Please enjoy this very thoughtful and insightful discussion. Hi, everyone. Thank you for joining us today for the special panel. I'm here today with Stuart and Eric, and I'm really excited to be here today with you guys because we're recording live the Responsible Luxury Podcast, which is home to responsible consumption and production for the world's leaders in the luxury space. And today we are shining the spotlight on these incredible leaders in the gemstone and mining communities. So with that, I wanted to give a brief introduction to our guests today. And next to me is Eric, who is the founder of Columbia Gem House, which is a family-run business since 1976. And Columbia Gem House formally established their Fair Trade Gems principles and protocols back in the early 2000s. Even some refer to Eric as the grandfather of responsible gemstone sourcing.
I know, it's sourcing.
By assigning a fair trade level to each gemstone, buyers can confidently understand the story behind their purchases. Additionally, to safeguard the story behind each gem, Columbia Gem House operates with its own cutting and heat treatment facilities and works directly with governments, nonprofits, and miners to ensure safety, fair wages, and environmentally responsible mining throughout their supply chain. And Stuart is a specialist in responsibly mined and fully traceable colored gemstones, mainly sourced directly from mines in Sri Lanka and Tanzania. Stuart runs gem trading companies 1948 and Crown Gems, as well as being one of the co-founders of Fair Luxury, a group focused on positive change in the jewelry industry, and a key member of the Moyo Gemstones Project. So with that, we'll give our guests special speakers a round of applause. So to get us started, Eric, I want to ask you your vision when you first started back in 1976, and you had this idea to start a company of Columbia Gem House. What were you thinking around this time?
Obviously, I wasn't thinking. So I had degrees in environmental planning and interior design. And I quit my environmental planning job at the time, and I had been just buying jewelry stones for designs for a number of years, and it sort of ran out of money. I thought, well, I better go sell some stones to try and pay the rent, and I just kept doing that. So it was quite different. It wasn't an intentional starting gems. It's just that, like some of the other compatriots in this room, actually sort of live them, you know, the industry, and it's so exciting to them. There just wasn't anything else to do at that point. So,
and you had we were talking briefly before I talked to you. You were mentioning 10, 20 years ago, you were talking for years about what a responsible gemstone industry should look like and telling traditional jewelers, you know, this is what you should be thinking. And there were naysayers out there, and now slowly but surely that vision is starting to come true.
It was pretty brutal in 2002 and 2003 when we started, because at that point, you know, we sold to traditional jewelers. There wasn't another market. iPhones hadn't come out yet. You know, there was really Instagram didn't exist, all of those things. So if you wanted to see colored stones, you went to a traditional jeweler. And the two things they didn't like is sapphires that weren't blue. So they had to be blue or they didn't want to see them. And the idea that we would talk about the conditions of production, both mining, cutting, how they came to market. We lost a lot of customers when we started doing that. So then over the years, we started seeing a change. The information on changing of interest in more variety of colored stones came with the iPhone. And that was in 2006, was the first iPhone that came out. And within a couple of years, people would ask about green sapphire, or they'd ask about gray spinel thing, because somebody was sending a picture of some cool stone they saw somewhere in the world. And so that's what really broadened the scope of colored stones. And then about 2015, the idea of traceable, supportive, responsible supply chains finally started getting some traction. And now every trade show, every magazine, everything has something about it every single time. So it's quite a change from 2002.
When it first started. That's amazing. And Stuart, when you, I always like to ask founders their journey early on. And when you're first starting the company, what your initial ideas and vision for your company was and what it is today. So just to set the grounds a little bit, I want to know more about 1948 and your ideas and feelings about starting this colored gemstone company.
Okay, yeah. So I'm much newer in the industry compared to Eric, as are most people. but I came into the industry properly, I would say, in 2012. So I've been planning the business a couple of years prior to that. And it was through a personal connection with Sri Lanka, which is the source of, still continues to be the source of many of the gemstones that I supply. And I think at that time, still, there was very little going on in terms of the traceability and the transparency. And so I'd come from an IT background. So I literally, in 2009, I would not have been able to tell you a sapphire from an emerald, quite literally. And so it was a very steep learning curve for me. But I'd come into the industry with no preconceived ideas, but I did have a strong belief that the things that I was going to sell and the things that I was going to supply, I wanted to know where they were from, and I wanted to be able to tell the story. Yeah. And I'd naively assumed that there would be lots of people who would be able to give me that information and it would be relatively straightforward. And of course, very quickly, I learned that that was not the case. And so then I found people who were like-minded, who were trying to change that situation and give more information, and building on the work that, you know, Eric had been doing for a decade or more, two decades before that. So that's how I entered the industry.
And some years later, here we are today talking about more of the industry. So traceability, responsible sourcing, and those are two central themes that you guys are, you know, what I want to say is when you look towards a traditional miner, a traditional cutter, a traditional stone dealer, they maybe meet the bare requirements of RJC. You guys are going much beyond that. And for the broader audience, perhaps for listeners and consumers outside of the day-to-day of the industry, what are you guys doing for traceability when starting working with these mines? Walk us through a little bit of your supply chain when you start to source them and then going further down the supply chain.
Here,
okay,
go for
sure.
There you go.
So, I'm not going to dwell too much on the IJC. One of the first things that I did when I was in the industry, I went to a trade show, I went straight up to the IJC booth. I said, this is what I'm planning to do. How can you help me? They didn't have a good response for me then. And they still, I don't believe, have a particularly good response for me right now. So we were very much left to our own devices. And you know, and we've already mentioned the fact that Columbia Gem House set up their fair trade principles for their gemstones. And that largely continues to be the case for our scale of businesses. And so what I learned very early on in my first trip to Sri Lanka was that, of course, the first thing I learned was that people could not give me any information, and that if I wanted that information, it was almost essential then. And so this is 11, 12 years ago, it was almost essential to actually own as much of the supply chain as you could, because that's the only way that you can then look your customers in the eye and say, I know about this gemstone. And so with my business partner in Sri Lanka, we very early on in 2013 set up our own mining operation. And then a few years later, we established our own cutting workshop. So we had ownership of the whole supply chain. And I think that's the fundamental thing that we wanted in the business, because we had full traceability. And on top of that, we were very happy to tell anyone who would listen, who had any questions, everything about our business. I've been astounded at the number of people who have taken the time and trouble to actually come to Sri Lanka and visit our mines and our cutting workshop themselves and see what we do. And we're very happy for that to happen. And it's great that Sri Lanka is particularly accessible, I would say, and in terms of a gem producing nation. So people are able to go there, freely look at the mines, and wander
short
around.
Trip of a lifetime for many.
Well, yes, I like to think so. Maybe not the mining part, but the overall trip, certainly. That's what I had to do. And of course, beyond that, there are systems and processes that we put in place to track the stones from their various locations and sources.
Yes, which I want to get to in a few minutes. Mm-hmm. And Eric, I want to hear more, you know, with Columbia Gem House. I know a big part of the business you guys have been working many years on is the cutting part and process. So walk us through how you guys started building this out and where you guys are today with the cutting process.
Yeah, it's interesting. When I have these talks, I think about traceability. If you people were mineral collectors, you would absolutely require the seller, the name, the origin, the exact location of that mineral. And then when we cut that mineral, an amethyst crystal, all of a sudden it goes into a big pile with amethyst looks the same, and you completely lose the origin. So it just never made sense. So if you go to mineral shows, every one of them will have origin on it. I mean, serious mineral shows, not, you know, collector shows. But we looked at it from the cutting point of view, and we could not, like Stuart's saying, you had to control that supply chain. We could not. I traveled around the world for the first 20 years of my life, going to gem mines and producing areas and meeting people. But there was no way for me to know where that specific amethyst was from when it came out of Bangkok. They were all mixed together. So in the early 80s, when China first opened up, matter of fact, the first 2 years, I couldn't go into the factory because in America, I couldn't get a visa. But we set up cutting in China in the early 80s. And that initially was, number one, to get the quality we wanted. But number two, to know the stones coming out of that factory, where they came from. Because that, I just thought that was a cool part of knowing about gemstones. But as we learn more, you know, for the last 10 or 15 years, we worked very hard in an area called silicosis abatement. And I probably don't have anything to base this statement on, but I would suspect that there's more people that die at the cutting facilities than at the mining locations. I don't have any mining location statistics to prove it, but I do have the cutting statistics. And it's from inhaling dust, particularly silicosis, which is silica. And it's sort of like black lung disease, only this is gem cutter disease. And many of the cutters know that they will make it for about 10 years and they'll die. But if it's your only way to make a living, you still do it. So we set up a system where our facility is. It was a rudimentary system that we hoped could be exported to other locations because it was not expensive. It was fairly easy to do. And so we have shared that at a lot of places around the world. But in our case, nobody's going to get lung diseases at our facility. And I believe in many cases, nobody will get them at some other facilities, partly because of the work we've done. So
that's amazing.
So that's really, to us, really important.
And when we're thinking about, we hear a lot of talks now on traceability and transparency and mine to market, mine to, you know, being sourced to the origin. I think that a lot of people are actively working towards this, but you guys have obviously been doing this for many years. And I'm curious to know more about the systems and protocols you guys have in place to for tracing these stones from the mines where you guys are working, your mines in some cases, and then to the cutting stage and then further down the supply chain.
All right. I guess I was talking. I'll keep going. In our case, we don't work in Antarctica, but I think every other continent in the world we work in. And because I traveled there for years and years, all the different places. Right now, if somebody wants to be a vendor for Columbia Gem House, it's not easy. We get people contacting us constantly, showing up at Tucson, which some of you know about, with bags of rough and want to sell it to us. But it's not that easy to sell to us. We have this whole series of reviews that we need to do about you and your company and the origins and how well you would document it before we will, you know, approve that person as a vendor. So some people just go, we're not going to do that. That's too much work. We have others that think it's like absolutely a great idea because it will talk about them, the people that work with them and their country. And they'd like to, what would you say? They're proud of that. And they'd like to project that information. But since Stuart works primarily in two areas, we work in, I don't know, too many, but they're not all equal. And it annoys the crap out of me when I get people sending stuff to me on Instagram and says, you know, we do X, Y, Z, we have ethical gemstones. Yep. And first of all, gemstones are just gemstones. They're not ethical. The people that sell them are. Or not. So we like to distinguish that. But in ours, we have, I hate to say it, different levels of our fair trade grading. And if it's level one, we know everything about it. We've been involved in the mining, everything all the way along. Level two is, you know, we know the mine a lot about it, but not as directly. Three would mean we're working with a vendor who has met our protocols for export, that it comes out of the country legally, that it's not smuggled, that it doesn't pay off bribes on the way. And we know the area and we have photos of the area where it's being mined, but we don't necessarily know that specific mine. So we give these different levels so people have an idea. We have some people that just say we only want level one and two. And that's just fine. We have others that say, look, you're making an effort. And so, you know, we'll support what you're doing, even if this one happens to be a four, because we need to buy it somewhere and at least you're making an effort. So ours is a pretty involved documentation chain from anybody who exports to us. We have our own export documents. This would be in addition to the Sri Lankan government or the Nigerian government or wherever. You have to fill out one of our export documents too, which is a lot more involved. And then that's what we use to base our traceability on. And we try and get all that information up on the web so people can read it.
Yeah.
So
you establish all of these protocols online. Wow. Okay. I'll make sure to add a link to that so people can take a look. It's important for data like that to be open source for people working toward wanting to work towards the same future as you are. It's really important. Yeah. Stuart, back to you.
So, yeah, so in my situation, as Eric said, I have a lot simpler circumstances. So I'm just primarily dealing with two locations.
Which are?
Sri Lanka and Tanzania. And so in Sri Lanka, we have, well, first of all, we're very fortunate that there's a very good framework there in terms of mining, gem trading, exporting. So it's possible to do everything fairly in a fairly straightforward manner and keep everything, you know, legal and follow the due process. So we can do that. On top of that, of course, within our own business, we have established our own systems for tracking and tracing the gem material from the mines through the cutting and to the point of export when it typically comes from Sri Lanka to me in the UK. And I mean, none of that is particularly glamorous. We're not putting in extensive computer systems or anything like that. We're not, you know, we're minimizing, in fact, our use of technology. We have to keep it, as with all these systems, I believe we have to keep it as easy as possible, especially at the point of extraction. And so I often see different technological suggestions, if you like, and they have not taken into account the reality at the mine site. So I think technology can play a role, and we have used some of it, but a lot of what we do is really down to having careful tracking, labeling of bags and that kind of thing, making sure things are segregated properly, recording all that on a basic spreadsheet and maintaining that through the whole supply chain. So yeah, it's relatively straightforward.
Yeah, I think partly what Stuart's doing is what we've seen. We hear a lot, well, blockchain will solve the problems. Mm-hmm. Blockchain doesn't solve problems. All they do is help you trace it. If you're dealing with an unethical or criminal element, it gets documented, sort of. But it doesn't solve the problem. People solve the problem. And what Stuart's talking about is more a people-to-people sort of system where if you have questions, you can talk to Stuart. And if he doesn't have the answer, he has the people down the line. He can get the answer for you.
It's that peer-to-peer network.
Yeah.
But having proof of that in technology could help underline what's already being done face-to-face.
It can. What we hear too often, I think I'm going to include Stuart in this comment, is that technology is the solution, and technology isn't the solution. It can help support the solution, but in and of itself, it's not the solution.
That was touched upon a little bit by Monica yesterday. Mm. I want to open it up more to talk about the broader ethos and philosophy of responsible luxury. And considering the intersection of the world that you guys work in color gemstones, and the broader jewelry industry, how do you believe we can engage both industry leaders and consumers in a more collaborative effort to redefine luxury in a way that prioritizes ethical sourcing, transparency, and respect for artisan skills and traditions?
That's a big question. No, I'm happy to go first. I think what I've seen in the industry in my decade or so is that a lot of the change has been facilitated from a grassroots level. And I think you get more kind of motivation, more energy coming from the individual designer makers, for example, the smaller businesses, people who want to make a difference. And through their collaboration, then they become a louder voice. And what I've seen and what I believe in is that by combining the smaller players, shall we say, in the industry, then we come to influence the bigger ones. And I think, as you mentioned earlier, that if you went back 10 years, certainly, and definitely any longer than that, that you would not have seen this topic being discussed anywhere in the industry, pretty much. And now, if you go to trade events, but also if you go to higher level, like you're saying, in the broader sense of the fashion industry, you see the topic is on the agenda everywhere, and the words are being used everywhere. That I won't get into that bit, but that brings us into a whole different topic of how the words are used and how the words are defined. But to your question, I think the way that we affect change is from the bottom up. I think that's where where we've seen the differences being made and those collective voices, and that just kind of gradually chipping away, and you know, you build up that momentum.
Yes.
And then suddenly you find that you're presenting at the UN or you're dealing with the British government and things like that that we have seen. Yeah. And okay, for better or worse, yeah, that you're doing those things, but you're achieving a level of prominence that wasn't there just a few years ago.
It's amazing because it should be intuitive, right? Because most of the time people believe that major change comes from the top down, from the leaders of the company, leading the company. And then it trickles down to the people on the ground. But in fact, like you said, real change comes from the ground up.
Yeah.
And
I think not least because it's the people at that level that understand the industry best. And so they know where the changes need to be made and to a certain extent how those changes can be made. And I think if you compare it to, say, the recent issues that we've had in terms of, say, diamond sanctions, where things have been coming from the top down and being imposed on the industry, and the industry has basically shrugged its shoulders and said, well, we're not really sure how we can implement these things that you're telling us. And that is definitely the wrong way around.
Yeah, there's some fragmented step between what they're communicating and the community talking, shaping these. I don't know, there needs to be more diverse perspectives sitting at the table, right?
Yeah.
For me, I try and stress when we're talking about this responsible sourcing, we talk so much about miners and cutters and overseas and that sort of thing, which is really important. But if we don't talk about the consumers, they are critical. Without the consumers, we don't have an industry. Those people don't have a job. I don't have a job. So we really try and find ways to bring consumers in projects that we do. And I will do a plug here. Right now, we and MJSA do the Responsible Jewelry Design Contest. And this is usually, or always, I guess, nine designers. And we donate the stones, we donate the metal. These nine designers make the pieces. And then, you know, one of them will win. And then we also then raffle off the pieces to raise funds for various different projects. And this year, we decided to do all American stones. So from Montana, Oregon, and Arizona, and we caught what leashes out to all those. And to us, responsible sourcing is people, but it's environment also. If they don't have an environment left to live in, it's not going to be very good. So we wanted to do an environmental one this year. So we reached out to the National Forest Foundation, who is doing what I'm going to call critical replanting in those three states, where they've fires or overlogging has really caused problems. So anyway, if anybody wants to put a ticket in on those, you can go over there and my daughter will help you. Or you can steal the book. But what this does, it involves consumers because we have a great many people that are putting, not jewelry industry people necessarily, putting this out on Instagram and on social media. It draws in consumers. They understand more why we're doing it. It features designers. Some of you people, you know, you get featured, and that's important because you're an important element of it. And it features the production, where the stones come from and how they're produced. So we're trying to do them where they are. You know, we've done various different ones, one to raise funds for the Navajo Reservation during COVID. We've done different ones, but each year is somewhat different. But.
And that takes place in October, the end of
this. Yeah, it's actually going right now.
Okay. So I want to expand horizons a bit and look forward into the future and pick your guys' brains a little bit about where you expect the industry to go, and also talk too about initiatives you guys are working on internally, what you're looking to work towards in the next couple of years, and also just speaking broadly to, you know, where you're looking and hoping the industry is going to go in the next 5 years or so.
Yeah, you go for it.
Next 5 years or so. Wow. Well, I would like to see, obviously, at least a continuation of the things that are going on currently. I think it's great that we are seeing much more discussion around this topic. I think we will see greater momentum in the minds of the consumers that I was mentioning. So I think that as, you know, access to information, it continues at such a pace that, you know, we have so much available to us now, and that generates hopefully many more questions in the minds of the consumers. Sure. So that may be a little bit of a naive hope, but we can aspire to that. And so through that, we will, like I say, see this greater momentum and a greater pace of change within the industry. So that's what I'd like to see. I think some of our industry associations and bodies need to probably step up even more than they are doing currently. I think we've seen some change, but there's plenty of scope for more. I think within the industry itself, the need for education is still huge.
Yeah.
I think we're only really, even now, just scratching the surface. And I know we have people in the room that are interested in this topic. That's great. And we have more access to this information and more activity around this kind of information than ever before. But until we're filling great big stadiums, we'll be on a much bigger stage in 5 years' time, possibly talking to larger groups of people and just making more people aware of the issues that continue to be present within the industry.
Yes. And also, yes, the issues, but also shining light on the work you guys are doing, because my big thesis for the industry is showing many use cases on how the work that you guys are doing is an engine for social growth, whatever communities you touch, economic and also environmental growth. And then I'm also very interested, you touched upon this, is getting more education to consumers. And I think that there's many people upstream, such as yourselves, working towards these initiatives. But then I see a potential challenge with connecting that gap further downstream. Mm. Once you get to that point of sale, we're working so hard on delivering this transparency. How are the consumers going to like digest this? And how can they be more interactive with this data? And so doing collaborations like what Columbia Gemhouse is doing with fundraisers and things, and working with local organizations, I think is a step forward and another good use case for, getting the broader public, broader, more diverse viewpoints involved in this conversation. So, and Eric, I'll also turn it over to you.
Yeah, I was asked that question in Chicago when I talked there, and I guess my answer was pretty short, and that was, I hope all of you who are in retail and working with consumers 5 years from now will be able to answer the questions that Monica gives you the information for. That you're in a position to pass this information along. And the only way to do that is, like a steward said, if we can do education and put it out there where you can read it at, I don't know, 11 o'clock at night when you're bored and you're on your computer or on your cell phone, and that you internalize that and that you can project that to the consumers, that is what will create the greatest change. So that's my hope.
And I like to ask this question because it gives you more artistic and creative freedom with how you envision the future. And if you were able to give maybe a piece of advice to a young entrepreneur starting off in the industry today, or a young business person, or perhaps even, I ask this on the show often, and it's, if you could, paint a billboard or a marketing campaign of something to depict the ideal state for the gemstone industry, what message would you want to deliver to the broader public? What's something that you would want it to say, and what's something that you would want them to understand?
Well, yes, I'll go first. Yeah. If you start a business, or if any of you are starting businesses, every business advisor is going to say, do a budget, do a plan, do a mission statement, do all this stuff. Because how do you start a business if you don't have any idea where your finances are going to come from, or how you're going to do marketing? And what we say is also, from the jewelry point of view, write down what you believe in. And publish that, put it on your website, put it wherever you can. And then you need to follow those. And sometimes it's really tough when you get there and you go, I really need this stone, but I can get that one, but I know it came out of Kivu in Eastern Congo. There's times where you just have to say, I can't do that. So write down what you believe in, and then set your your business plan to help follow that?
I think my advice would be, certainly to solo entrepreneurs, would be to reach out to the people in the industry that are doing the things that you aspire to do. Because I think within our industry, whether it's as a supplier, whether it's as a maker, a lot of the activities can be quite isolated. And so you quite often, and one of the, in fact, the reasons why we started the Fair Luxury community in the UK was that people can be sat there thinking, I'm the only person thinking like this. And you're not, you're absolutely not. But you need to find your community to be able to share those ideas and to get strength from that. I think that it's easy to, you know, if you're in isolation, of course, it's much easier to think, I'm never going to surmount these problems that look huge. Even though I'm blessed to have these people, you know, this group that I work with, and I know we're all going in the same direction. And some days you think, wow, these problems, they're massive. We'll never get over them. But, you know, slowly but surely we can. And so I think if you're starting off, then it's really important to find those few people that believe in the same things that you do.
Yeah.
And that gives you that strength on the days when it looks really difficult.
Yes, uniting minds towards a single problem. Humanity has a really skilled ability to go further together. And we always talk about collaboration is very powerful. So I love that. So thank you guys so much. All right, that's a wrap. Thank you guys so much. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to the Responsible Luxury Podcast. If you haven't already, please rate and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. If you have any questions you want answered or ideas to share, please reach out to us at Responsible Luxury Pod or connect with me directly. And don't forget to follow at Responsible Luxury Pod for the latest updates. I will talk to you soon. Bye for now.